Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. As the first executive director of Pennsylvania's Office of Open Records, Terry Mutchler staunchly defended the public's right to know. But sharing her own story was another matter. Mutchler chronicles her secret five-year relationship with the late Illinois Senator Penny Severance in her critically acclaimed book, Under This Beautiful Dome, A Senator, A Journalist, and the Politics of Gay Love in America. We'll talk with her about open records law, about her journalistic roots at Penn State, and about the impact her disclosure had on her career. Terry Mutchler, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You've enjoyed an impressive list of firsts in a colorful career that began at Penn State, where you earned your undergraduate degree. You went on to become a reporter and later a managing editor for the Penn State newspaper, the Daily Collegian. What, first of all, inspired you to want to be a reporter?
Well, it's interesting because when I came to Penn State, I knew I wanted a big university. I had come from a small hometown.
The Poconos.
I was in East Stroudsburg. Had a great experience there, but I wanted to be in a community where I could get lost if I wanted to and yet have a niche at the same time. And I thought enough of myself at the time that I thought I could do a walk-on on the Penn State field hockey team. In any event, I lasted about 3 days in the tryouts, and I was not cut out for that Division I level. So I remember sitting under a tree over by Pollock Fields and thinking to myself, oh my goodness, what are you going to do now? And because I wanted to do something in extracurricular world. I'd always liked to write. And I saw this ad that said, come try out for the Daily Collegian. And I went and tried out. And I was one of the few freshmen that made the cut. And I knew I had found my place. So I cut my reporting teeth at the Collegian. And once I started to understand the business and how that worked, I knew I was hooked for a long time.
Now, you won a number of awards, the Keystone Award in Pennsylvania. You were the first woman, but also the youngest reporter in the nation to be appointed the AP bureau chief and State House correspondent. This was in Illinois.
Yes.
First of all, did you feel pressure as a result of that?
I did feel a lot of pressure.
And I should mention you were 27 years old.
I was 27 at the time, yes. I had done a lot of cutting-edge reporting in Pennsylvania for the AP and also for the Associated Press in Atlantic City. They had asked me to take over the Illinois State House. They wanted to do, at the time, what was considered cutting-edge computer-assisted reporting. And they really wanted to dig into the kind of the graft that is Illinois politics, or can be. So I went there. I was the youngest. I was the first woman. And, you know, perhaps young enough not to really understand that mantle at the time, although I did feel some pressure. Yeah, I felt like I had to succeed.
And ironically enough, I guess, you end up not long on the job.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Well, seeing Senator Penny Severance and literally falling in love at first sight, which, of course, is more than a little bit of a problem for the AP bureau chief.
Absolutely.
Covering the Senate.
Right. It was certainly... you know, there's no way to sugarcoat this one. I was clearly in the wrong in that way from a journalism perspective. I write about in the book, the day that I had seen Penny, I did not know who she was, didn't know she was a lawmaker. I end up calling a friend of mine in New York, a former reporter, and saying to her, you know, I think I just fell in love. And as we when I finally figured out who Penny was, and my friend in New York called me and for days was like, look, Terry, you're the first woman, you're the first bureau chief, the youngest, you cannot do this. And I did not heed that advice, and I got myself into a wonderful relationship, but a terrible ethical conundrum that cast a pall over that relationship, in fact, for many years to come. Clearly, as the head of the AP in Springfield, what I should have done in retrospect was gone to the AP and said, look, I am in love with this woman, I am gonna pursue this relationship, and somehow built a firewall around covering the Senate.
And in
but
fact,
I didn't do that.
And in fact, you'd done that earlier in your career.
I did.
When you had a relationship with a legislative staffer who
yes.
happened to be a man.
Yes.
And they did create that firewall.
I did. I was, you know, I went to Rich Kirkpatrick, who was at the head of the AP in Harrisburg, and after I had been out on a few dates with a staffer from the House Speaker's staff, I said to him, Rich, listen, I think this relationship is going to be a long one, and I want to disclose it. and it was very clean and ethical and simple. He thanked me. He, you know, laid down the parameters that I could not cover the house and any story that had an implication, you know, where there could have been an implication, he made sure it was vetted. It became difficult in Illinois when that scenario happened again, and I fell in love with a woman. And that was very complicated for me personally. I was not out. Also at the time in central Illinois in the 90s, I mean, clearly Penny would have lost her Senate seat, I think. You never really can tell in retrospect, but it would not
this
have been an easy.
This is 1993.
Yeah, it would not have been an easy disclosure. Having said that, courage is doing the, you know, the right thing in real time. And, you know, that wasn't even, like, that wasn't even a gray area. You know, clearly should not have been in that position or in that relationship at the same time.
In fact, you've called it the biggest regret of your life and unforgivable. I'm wondering if at this stage, more than 20 years out, you've forgiven yourself for that.
I have, in a way, but in the sense that it doesn't keep me up at night. However, where I do have a problem is I still get caught when I describe myself as a former journalist.
And you hate the word former.
I did disservice to that profession by being involved with a source. And in journalism at the time, it really was unforgivable. Short of committing a crime, in journalism, what's the biggest ethical breach you could commit? And so I've done some other events on a book tour, and a lot of the moderators have said to me, well, you know, Terry, it was at the time, it was, you know, in that moment, you know, like all these explanations. And that is true. It was clearly a very closeted community. I was too young to really, you know, understand the full breadth of that, I think. And also, I was not mature enough to really deal with my own issues of being closeted. And then on top of that, you know, you have this very powerful Illinois senator.
She's,
you know,
14 in the mix. Years your
yeah,
senior.
Yeah, she was. But I didn't handle that well. It was, in a journalism context, unforgivable. At the same time, I knew that nothing was going to keep me from that relationship.
Interesting, because you recall in your book, and you say it very often, that there was a professor at Penn State who brought in an editor from the Inquirer, who said, I don't care if you're screwing around with the elephants as long as you're not covering the circus.
That's right. So, I believe it's, you know, I mean, writing about it in retrospect, what has been interesting to me, what was interesting to me, is that that became, even though that was huge at the time and a huge part of my journalism career, if you will, it became such a subset to the story. I think it's why I was able to write about it as straightforwardly as I did.
As honestly. And,
you know, well, you know, on something like that, it's like your viewers is the same as readers. They can smell authenticity, and they can smell when you're not being authentic. There was no way to sugarcoat that story in a way, any other way than here was the ethical breach. And having been a press secretary and serving in other political capacities, could I spin it? I guess, but none of it would be authentic. I mean, the reality is I was involved with the source. I shouldn't have been, and I stayed in it too long.
Did it influence how you reported on her or what was going on in the Senate? And sometimes I think you recused yourself from some of the stories, but you had to edit them all.
Yeah, I think that it did, because that's like saying, you know, if we went to a restaurant and we said, oh, the mouse is only on the corner of the plate, you know, you can't make those kinds of distinctions. For readers, what they needed to know was either that the full truth, so that they could make a determination about the veracity of this story, or alternatively, I needed not to put myself in that position of covering somebody that I was involved with. I do think, in retrospect, at the beginning, I reported a little bit harder at the beginning. Like, I remember Penny,
more critically, do you mean?
Yeah. I remember Penny and a group of lawmakers took a junket to Israel. And I, through her, knew, of course, every lawmaker that was on that, you know, trip, and what the expenses were, and I just plastered all of it. I mean, I wrote everything about that. And but I can honestly also say that then the coverage became slanted because of my relationship. And I write about it in the book. There was a, Penny had, I believe at that point, it was a second surgery to remove.
For breast cancer.
For breast cancer, of which she ultimately died.
In 1998.
Yes. And in 1994, I think it was, I'm trying to remember, but after one of the initial surgeries related to it, of course, actually it was 1994 because she was running for lieutenant governor. I, of course, was at the house, but I was a secret. And so all the news coverage, nobody could get in touch with her, all the news coverage was that she was convalescing at home. She had made a remark that she, you know, was tired of reading about this, particularly when you're in a statewide race for the governorship. I asked her a few questions, how she felt, picked up the phone, called the AP, and dictated a story that she was working from home, doing, you know. So clearly, it wasn't that I privately, at the beginning, I tried to, even though it was still wrong, I tried to carve out where, you know, to keep myself out of it. And then that eventually fell by the wayside as well. We stayed in that ethical conundrum for just under a year when, for reasons that I write about in the book as well, I went to Alaska. And it was kind of a combination of reasons. But what I find fascinating in retrospect is that more than talking about the secrecy or coming out, Penny and I talked about the ethical conundrum of the situation more than we did about the obvious elephant in the room, which was that we were two women involved and should be out. It was very interesting.
And here you were parking your car either blocks, sometimes more than a mile away, going in the back door of your own home.
Yeah. I still cringe when I think about the things that we and I did to keep this relationship secret. I would park 2 miles away from our house. I'd make sure it was dark. Penny and I, the same in the reverse when she was, you know, we kept an apartment for show. You know, we did some, one of the craziest things we did that I write about in the book is for those people that have housekeepers or cleaning ladies, we would get up and sort of clean for the cleaning lady. And in retrospect, one of the most toxic things I recall.
Your hair.
And I wrote about, I used to have very long hair and I would lint roll my hair from the sheets and from the floor. And my hair was very long. It was like down to my waist.
And it clearly would not have been Penny's long
hair. Right, because she had short hair. And, you know, and the level of what we did to maintain that secret, even after I left journalism, was incredible.
Now, it's not lost on anyone that you went from this secret. You went to Alaska, you came back, you started law school, so mm-hmm. you're no longer working for the AP. And you became Penny Severin's press secretary. So
right.
now you could be with her, and it made
right.
sense for you to be
right.
with her. But your career after that, you become a lawyer, and you end up being called by Governor Ed Rendell to head up the very first Pennsylvania Open Records Office.
Right.
The irony in that is just, the person who kept secrets is
right.
now helping journalists and media and corporations find out information about government.
Yeah, it's certainly, ironic. It also, what's interesting to me, and I think it even stems further back than the relationship, is I've spoken a little bit about this, but since I've became a journalist, even here at the Daily Collegian, I use the open records laws. I was familiar with the Freedom of Information Act, fighting for transparency, etc. What I find even more ironic than after sort of being the government secret that I was assigned to disclose, if you will, was taking this position at the Office of Open Records. I also find it ironic, and I'm sure some therapists would have a lot to say about this, but I also think it stems from a very tumultuous young life. I was a victim of sexual assault. I think that my family, you know, you're bought into the concept of keeping secrets.
The seeds of secrecy,
yeah,
you
exactly.
said, were sown there.
Yeah, and I think I was very well trained to keep secrets, and it almost became, kind of not natural, but it was certainly very familiar. But what I find interesting is around the same time as the sexual assault occurred.
You were 10.
I was 10. It was around that time that I started to want to become a lawyer. And, you know, those dynamics are interesting to me because clearly my personal life was in a shambles and it was deeply closeted. And yet I'm, you know, somewhere inside me, I wanted the light out there in some fashion. And so I think that the professional and the personal, it eventually, of course, collided. and thus the book.
And in a lot of ways, as you say, almost killed you, this secret, keeping this secret almost killed you. And I came across a quote that I loved, and this was spoken by philosopher Ayn Rand. She said, "The man who lies to the world is the world's slave from then on." So
well,
I'm just
true.
Wondering, once you unburdened yourself of this secret, how cathartic was it? And how difficult was it to write this book that you didn't publish until 2014?
Yeah. You know, the first time that I came out was 2 years after Penny had died. So, I mean, I was really very much wedded to this secret. And she and I, even though we had talked many times about finding our way out, wanting to, not in a, you know, some kind of a grandstand way, but we had planned this one event where we were going to have a picnic and we were going to invite people over. And I don't know what exactly we were thinking because, you
this
know.
This fantasy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're going to invite people over, not explain why I'm there. And yet, I mean, everybody kind of knew anyway in one regard. But when I did come out finally, I still had a lot of work to do because I had a lot of reckoning, if you will, both personal and professional to deal with. And also, it was very difficult to make the choice, in one hand, about, you know, Penny was my key confidant. I did not have that anymore. So I was making these decisions, you know.
In isolation
and by myself still. You know, and I always find that it's fascinating that there are threads of secrecy that still can find you in some fashion or tie you up in a way. I would tell people the story of being locked out of my home and the story that I had with the end of Penny's life.
Because the Severin family didn't acknowledge that you were her wife or her
right.
partner, and they said you were just friends, and
right.
so literally you're booted out of your house, can't get into the house that, and your
we
name
bought together,
together and
right.
your name would have been on the deed, except that you consciously said there is a record.
It's a public record.
Public record, and someone could see the deed transfer and both of our names on it.
Right.
Wow.
And so, you know, and at the time, of course, this is all against the rubric of you're young and you think you're invincible. It never dawned on me that, you know, that our life together or her life would end, you know, 5 or 6 years. So you make these decisions where you always think you have time to figure it out, and you don't always have time to figure it out. So when I started to tell people the story, there were people that would say to me, you really need to write this. And when I had started writing the book, I started writing in 2004. And I did it primarily out of fear that I would forget Penny or forget the stories, and which is really impossible, but you don't know that when you're in the midst of grief. And so I started to write them, and then I put it away for a very long time. And then people would say, you need to do something. At the same time, you had this cacophony of a sea change happening in the United States related to gay marriage, and this sea change coming in at the same time that I'm figuring out this is an important story and I should do something with this.
In fact, when your book came out, I think 9 states
was,
allowed
right, exactly.
Same-sex marriage. By 2015, President Obama, I think maybe 2014, he said he supports it.
Right.
And the next year, the U.S. Supreme Court made it legal in all 50 states.
Yeah, it was a remarkable time frame. And also, I think even though I know that people had been advocating for this for obviously decades and longer, it also in that window of time for me seemed to happen very fast. It seemed like from the 90s forward was like you couldn't anticipate how quickly the change had occurred.
Now, the interesting thing is that part of the reason you didn't come out was because to a large extent, you didn't even acknowledge yourself as gay.
Yeah.
You were homophobic.
Absolutely. I think that one of the hard revelations in the book for myself, realizations, you know, Penny and I had the quick answer that, oh, we can't come out because she was a lawmaker, I was an AP reporter. In deeper retrospect, I think we were both homophobic, and I think that we couldn't quite grasp that. Now, she got through that much quicker than I did. I grew up in a very religious and fundamentalist household where it was very biblically based, and I got a great deal out of that and still rely on faith in a very deep way. I just never really worked through some of the issues that I was having, so for me it became more of a noose in a way. Penny kind of got through it, and then it just became the practical reality of when are we going to come out, which over time we talked about. But it was a much different road for me. It was a very isolating road.
Interestingly, she had a colleague come out in the state Senate in 1996. She died in 1998. I'm just wondering if you have some sense of whether, especially since you had were no longer reporting on the on the state Senate, whether looking back you think, you know, we might have been not long after that.
Well, you never can really say what would have happened, which is another hard piece of the thing, because I can only say what I think would have happened, obviously, since she died. I don't think Penny would have ever stood up on the floor and given a speech. But I do think that we would have, and we're moving toward letting people into our lives in a real way. Because, I mean, it was like, you think about being in a closet, we were like in a shoebox in a closet. I mean, it was really claustrophobic.
Interestingly, though, it was your story that was presented on the floor of the Senate when they said it's time for Illinois to accept gay marriage.
In fact, that's where the title of the book came from. It was ironic because Representative Ann Williams, who is in Illinois and who I did not know in my relationship with Penny, but she and I became friends when she was at the Attorney General's office in Illinois. She was a sponsor of this legislation. She knew the story. She felt the need and wanted to tell this story, thought it would resonate with her lawmaking colleagues. And she started by saying, one of the most beautiful stories I ever heard happened under this beautiful dome. And interestingly enough, unbeknownst to her, Penny, many years before that, had said to me that she could never walk into the Capitol without looking at the moonlight that spilled into this beautiful dome. And so that was not the original title of the book, but when the publicist read the book, she immediately picked this up and was like, this is the title of the book. So that's where it came out of.
What's been the reaction to the book?
I have had a tremendous amount of reaction to the book, mostly virtually all good. You know, I've gotten very positive reviews. I've had a lot of people reach out. Interestingly, and I still am trying to figure this out myself, the largest demographic of people that write to me, you know, you would normally think, oh, they're either young, coming out, or they're closeted gays and lesbians. But it's not. The demographic of people that write to me more than any other demographic are straight men and women who are in affairs. And they talk about
the lie.
The lie and the toxicity of it. And I found that to be kind of fascinating, really. I've also, now that I'm comfortable with the book, I know that sounds like a weird thing to say since I've lived with it for so long, but when I speak about it, I'm in a much more comfortable spot. Now when I go speak to advanced journalism classes or to journalists themselves, I talk with them about how a reporter could have discovered that story if they would have been paying attention, using the Right to Know law, the Freedom of Information Act, travel records, phone records, any of that stuff. So I'm sure there's some fisherman's knot that this is called. I just can't think of the name of it. Maybe it's the Gordian knot, I don't know.
Well, how hard is it for you today to not be a journalist, to have to say former journalist?
You know, I don't miss journalism. There are times, though, when many of my clients are journalists, and when they're onto something, I feel that old rush of adrenaline. But my role is different, and I feel like I took myself out of that game a long time ago. And I actually don't think, I think I'm in the right spot. I'm in the right spot guiding them from the legal component.
Yes, so now at Pepper Hamilton, you're actually helping journalists and historians and corporations get the information they need using our Right to Know laws. Are they doing what they were intended to do?
Well, Pennsylvania's Right to Know law is very strong. And I still think that, you know, it was 49th in the nation among the worst prior to the rewrite in 2008. In the years since, it's been upgraded, for lack of a better word, to as high as 5 in some polls.
And some people refer to it as the Pennsylvania model.
Yes, they do. And the reason for that is Pennsylvania is one of only 3 states that have a binding independent agency to review records requests. So if you're in Illinois or Connecticut or Pennsylvania, you can, if you were denied access to a record, you can go to, in our case, the Office of Open Records, and they have binding authority. It's not just, we think this should be released. The agency has to release it unless the agency goes to court. So I think that the state law is very good. This, as you know, is the 50th anniversary of the Freedom of Information Act this year. On July 4th, 1966, President Johnson signed it into law. The Freedom of Information Act has a lot of problems, and I think that we need to really rewrite it.
One of the ones that to me is the most fascinating is that what's absolutely overwhelming the right to know law at the federal level is companies coming to agencies and demanding information under the right to know law, mm-hmm. but this is information that they're using and reselling.
Reselling.
And the result of that is a backlog of hundreds of thousands of requests.
Right.
Journalists and historians and others who need information for work they're doing can't get it. They're
right.
delayed or put off or denied.
And that's the same in Pennsylvania. I think it's a real, it's a crisis, actually, in this, in open records world, at least, because the reality is commercial requesters should not be using this law to obtain records to go sell. It harms the taxpayer. It harms the process.
We're paying for them, you know, to get this free information.
Basically, yeah, and then they go sell it. And, you know, there's some examples of that with people that, you know, they're going to start a dog grooming business, so they go get the dog licenses. They own a pool liner business and they want to know who's putting in pools this summer. You know, the list is kind of endless in that way. I believe that the solution is to have a bifurcated mechanism where commercial requesters pay. They can get it, but it's a different time frame. It's all of that. I think the priority should be to journalists and citizens and historians to obtain that information, but they need to be separated out, absolutely, because they are part of the holdup here.
There are lots of people who say what we ought to do, agencies ought to be putting this information online before they're even asked for
it. And I think that, I mean, there is absolute statistical evidence to demonstrate that when an agency, the more public record it puts on a website, the less the requests they receive.
Sense.
There are agencies now in Seattle and Oregon that are 100% paperless. All of their material is on a website. They get maybe one or two a year in a request, and that's because people don't even, you know, they just don't know that it's there on the website.
You mentioned where Pennsylvania ranked before 2008, and you started the Office of mm-hmm. Open Records in Pennsylvania, and that makes me think of the situation in Michigan, one of two states mm-hmm. that doesn't have right-to-know laws, and as a result, when we're watching the Flint River tainted water scandal, and they are not releasing
right.
any of their records.
They have a Freedom of Information Act there, but the governor's office is exempt from that.
Right, right.
And
sorry,
so,
I
know what you meant there. Because in a sense, what you're saying is accurate. That it, for all intents and purposes, they don't have one if they're not subject. You know, so I think that that is a premier example of what could have been prevented if citizens and journalists would have had access to records. You see the very same thing occurring in Pennsylvania, not so much with the water, but with the gas drilling, the fracking, and the results of water surveys in that. There's legislation pending that would preclude release of any of the water samples. I don't agree with that. I think that, you know, if Flint teaches us nothing, it should teach us that citizens should have access to the records of their government so that they can make these types of determinations about it.
In closing, Terry, why do you think right-to-know laws are so important?
I truly believe that citizens own this government, and I know it sounds a little geekish, but even the framers of the Constitution, their fifth grievance against the king was that he kept public records away from the legislatures for the sole purpose of fatiguing citizens into compliance. That plays out every day in the United States under the Open Records Act, and I feel strongly that it shouldn't be that way.
And on that note, we are out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us.
That was my great pleasure. Thank you. I appreciated all your questions.
That was Penn State alum Terry Mutchler. Today, she heads the nation's first transparency practice group at the law firm of Pepper Hamilton in Philadelphia, where she helps corporations, the news media, and government officials navigate the complex world of open records law. Her Pulitzer Prize-nominated book is Under This Beautiful Dome, A Senator, A Journalist, and the Politics of Gay Love in America. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.